From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Children seriously ill with COVID-19 continue to fill intensive care units and hospitals around the country. Yesterday, Dr. Anthony Fauci sounded the alarm.
There's no doubt that there are more children getting infected. As I mentioned in one of my slides, the Delta variant is much more highly transmissible than was Alpha. Even though the percentage is small, certain percentage of children will require hospitalization.
In fact, according to the CDC, nearly 1,600 kids with COVID were hospitalized last week. It was a new 7-day record. One of those children, 14-year-old Serena Gonzalez from San Antonio, who was put on a ventilator after she arrived at the hospital a week ago. Her mother, Elizabeth Gonzalez, joins us now. Elizabeth, thank you for making some time for us.
Thank you so much, Peter, for having me.
And how is your daughter, Serena, doing right now?
Today, we can actually, I can breathe and have a sigh of relief. She is doing a wonderful turnaround. She's up and moving, which is great, and with limited oxygen as of today.
Well, thank goodness. You think she's out of the woods?
I do believe that she is out of the woods. I'm hoping soon, within the next few days, probably get to talk about going home. So, yes.
I can't even imagine what it would be like to watch one of your daughters on a ventilator suffering. Serena's 14 years old. She should be getting ready to start high school. What was that like?
Well, you know, I guess I'll start this way, Peter. I was very unfortunate. As a mother, I was not by her bedside. I myself was in another hospital with COVID trying to breathe myself. And I got the phone call Friday that they had to intubate her and she had to be on a ventilator. The only comfort I had was the doctor on the phone telling me they were going to take very good care of her. And we were fortunate to have my father by her side, but it was not the same as a mom being next to your child, seeing it with your eyes and letting her know it's going to be okay. So it was very terrifying. I would have never imagined that this COVID would have hit our family and our children as strong as it did, considering that we are a very healthy family. So to answer your question, Peter, it was very hard.
I can't imagine. But I do want to ask you something. I understand that she was not vaccinated. She's 14. She could have been. And that also you and your husband were also unvaccinated. Can you help me understand why?
Of course, Peter. There's a lot of unawareness in the sense of thinking that in this aspect that you're a healthy family. You'll get over it. If you get it, it's not a big deal. You're strong. And I think the mindset that my husband and I had was, we're fine. But I will tell you, after knowing our health background, knowing that we're not immune to this, the first thing we're doing when we are out of our quarantine and everybody's home as a family, we will be getting vaccinated. We will not allow our children to go through this because there's no reason for them to go through this.
You know, I know so many parents, I've spoken with them, are thinking like, you know, COVID isn't so bad for kids. They might get it, but maybe they'll just get the sniffles. You know, it's not going to land them in the hospital. We know that's not true because look what happened to your family. Did you think that before all of this happened?
100%, Peter. And this is, I think, the good thing I got to see between two children, a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old that are fully healthy, and how each one of them is different in the response to being COVID positive. My 12-year-old spent just a few days in a hospital, no intubation, a little bit of oxygen, but she still had to be in a hospital. My 14-year-old, same situation, no vaccination, fully healthy, got COVID, and it was extremely life-threatening to a point of being on a ventilation. So I'm seeing with my own eyes, as a normal walking person out here, how COVID can be different for each person. I'm seeing it myself.
You live in Texas. This is a state where politicians have made masks and vaccine requirements illegal. Schools are getting underway. As I said, your daughter should be starting high school. Hospitals are full of kids like Serena. In a word, what do you want families to know?
What I want families to know is that if we can do whatever we can to take the right precaution, even if we don't know the whole answer, then why not take that chance? Why not make a choice to get vaccinated? You don't have to, but make the choice to get vaccinated. Make the choice to wear your mask. Make the choice to do social distancing. Nobody has to tell us to do that. We can make our own choice for ourselves and for our kids. And if the worst thing that comes from that is that our child might have a flu-like symptom, then we can be so thankful. But if we don't do anything, then we know that we're facing a place where your child can literally be fighting for their life. One day, healthy family. One day, I don't know if my daughter's going to wake up. You don't have to be in the battle. You can make the choice to make those decisions and be safe. You have that choice. We have that choice. We don't have to wait for somebody to tell us.
Elizabeth Gonzalez, her 14-year-old daughter, Serena, has been hospitalized with COVID-19 since last Friday in San Antonio. She was intubated. Elizabeth, I understand your husband is still in the hospital recovering from COVID. So thank you for making the time to speak with us. And we are wishing you and all of your family good health. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Peter.
To Congress now, where Democrats in the House have two big priorities, a big infrastructure bill, and a $3.5 trillion budget plan with significant social spending. The Democrats have the majority, but there is trouble afoot. This morning, 9 swing Democrats wrote to Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying they will not support the budget plan until the House first takes up infrastructure. And that happens to be the opposite of how Pelosi and liberal Democrats want to proceed. The lead signatory of the letter is Congressman Josh Gottheimer, Democrat of New Jersey. And Congressman, the Speaker has said no vote on infrastructure until the budget plan moves. But your letter suggests there's some hardball going on in the party, does it not?
Well, I think more suggesting that the president, who has made clear, and right after the, as you pointed out, an historic once-in-a-century package on infrastructure, bipartisan, passed the House last week, that we should get it to his desk as quickly as possible. You know, you've got 2 million jobs a year on the line, and it's time to get shovels in the ground, given where our infrastructure is as a country. And all we're saying is, let's finish that up. Let's get that passed. You've got a bird in the hand here, and we've got strong support in the House for it. We can vote on it. And then, of course, also then get to work on reconciliation.
Now, these are long-term investments in the economy, right? Generational investments in the power grid and roads and bridges and water and ports. What's wrong with waiting a few months, Congressman?
Well, if you drive around my district in Jersey here, we've got the third worst roads in the country. We've got a tunnel between New York and New Jersey that's 113 years old. A third of our bridges are considered unsafe. We really can't afford to wait anymore. And also, the idea that we would risk squandering this once-in-a-century package, you know, months in politics are always dangerous, right? You just want to get this done and make sure you move forward. And we've got support from Democrats and Republicans. And interestingly, right, Labor's with us, AFL-CIO has backed this in a big way, and so has the Chamber of Commerce.
I heard you say the word squandering. You're a moderate in your caucus. But many of your progressive colleagues say they will not support infrastructure, roads and bridges in every district, unless the budget plan goes first. So could this dispute potentially undermine both of these bills?
Well, my feeling is, you know, as we should proceed the same way the Senate did. And it was good enough, of course, for Bernie Sanders. And he supported making sure that we vote first on this infrastructure package and then do the budget resolution to move reconciliation forward. And as you said, this is about our crumbling roads and bridges and tunnels, historic investments in mass transit and water infrastructure and electric vehicles and climate resiliency and all the things that we're desperate for to stay competitive as a country. And, you know, the idea that we would wait an unnecessary delay for no reason makes no sense to us. And that's all we're saying today is let's just get this done the way the Senate did, and then let's move forward.
And very quickly, Congressman, your party controls both chambers in Congress and the White House. I mean, what is the message this potential logjam sends to the American public about the Democrats' ability to get things done here?
Well, I think that's exactly why we're making this push, which is let's get it done. And I believe we will. You know, we'll figure it out. We'll work together. But I think the big message is let's not wait months for getting this infrastructure package moving and those jobs moving and shovels in the ground. Let's pass it in the House in the next couple of weeks and get to work. And of course, again, we can pivot to other things that are in reconciliation, like reinstating the state and local tax deduction or SALT and investing in childcare and hearing and dental for Medicare and the climate. There's so many other things that are important. But for now, to let anybody hold this bipartisan package hostage makes no sense. So we're going to, you know, that's our message to the speaker and to leadership.
That is Congressman Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey, the district in the northern part of the state. He's co-chair of the Bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
So great to be here. Thanks so much.
The 2020 census paints a new picture of the United States, a country more racially and ethnically diverse than the past decade, and changing demographics suggest a changing electorate. Today, we'll parse the biggest data dump so far in the census. One nugget is that the number of U.S. residents who identify with more than one race has tripled in the past decade. There are, though, questions about how complete and how valid the data are. Let's bring in our census watcher and NPR correspondent, Hansi Lo Wang. Hi, Hansi.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, one big picture question at the start. What do you take away as far as how the country has changed and how fast in a decade?
We're seeing more racial and ethnic diversity across the country, especially among children. And there's been an increase in the number of people who, when they answer the questions about race and ethnicity on the census forms, they're checking off boxes for more than one group. It's also important to keep in mind that the 2020 census shows that the largest racial or ethnic group in the U.S. remains the white population. But there are some interesting changes within that population. Compared to 2010, the Census Bureau says, the share of people who checked off only the white box on census forms dropped by about 9%. But the share of people who checked off white and one or more other racial group increased by more than 300%. So some interesting changes happening.
Yeah, I want to ask you about these numbers on what statistically, I guess, are multiracial people here in the U.S. You mentioned this triple, 300% jump to more than 30 million people, I gather. I mean, that's one in 10 people in this country. What's going on here?
Right. That increase of almost 300% of folks who are identifying with more than one racial group, it could be, you know, we don't know for sure. It could be what demographers have been expecting. They've been tracking trends of increasingly more people who are the children of couples of different racial groups, and that the children of these couples are identifying with more than one racial group. That could be one factor. Another factor is maybe how the Census Bureau changed how it recorded and sorted through the write-in responses some people made to the census forms when answering the race and ethnicity question. And in that way, those changes could have helped increase the number of multiracial people counted for the 2020 census.
Okay, so there could be a process explanation here as well. I want to ask you a little bit more about the process of this particular count. I remember it was delayed. It was cut short at one point. I mean, how challenging was this particular census endeavor this time around?
This census was a hot mess, and it was a lot of it was through the interference of former President Donald Trump's administration, which had a failed push to add a citizenship question to the census forms, a type of question that the Census Bureau's research found that would have decreased the participation of Latinos, Asian Americans. This question did not happen, but it certainly cast a pall over the count. And then COVID happened. And then in the middle of COVID, which delayed census operations, specifically door knocking efforts, which are really key to getting people of color, immigrants, rural residents, historically undercounted groups counted. Door knocking was pushed back, delayed, and then, as you said, the counting efforts were cut short by the Trump administration. So it was a very tumultuous count.
So when you put this all together, does this raise any questions about the reliability of these numbers?
That question has been hanging over this census even before counting began, and it certainly is hanging over right now, we won't know for sure until the Census Bureau releases more quality metrics, and we'll see how, when researchers are digging through this data, what analysis they come up with. But right now, there are concerns that there could be an undercount of Black people, Latinos, Native Americans, all groups that were undercounted in 2010. We do know right now that there was a high rate of households not answering the race and what's called the Hispanic origin question on the 2020 census forms. But the bottom line at this point is that the country is going to have to live with these results in many ways, because this release of this data was delayed for more than 4 months. And as a result, many states are facing looming deadlines to use this data to redraw voting districts for the next 10 years of elections.
And quickly, you mentioned voting. Took a look at the map of the states that are increasingly diverse. I mean, these are important political places, Texas, Florida, Nevada. What are the presidential election implications here?
There are major election implications for the next 10 years at every level of government, from Congress, state houses, local government. This is usually a very highly partisan process of redrawing voting maps according to the population. And this time around, there's also going to be a time crunch. Some states have really early deadlines to finish drafting maps. Some in Ohio, the Redistricting Commission has less than 3 weeks to finish their first draft maps. And so it's a big question right now how that will complicate this whole process that, again, is going to set up democracy in this country for the next 10 years.
All right, that is NPR's census correspondent Hansi Lo Wang. Hansi, thanks as always.
You're very welcome, Scott.
The Pacific Northwest is again feeling the impacts of climate change. Another heat wave is baking the region with triple-digit temperatures. And as we reported in late June, hundreds of people died in Oregon and Washington and to the north in British Columbia because of record heat. Our next guest says the 96 deaths in Oregon attributed to that heat wave could have been prevented. Vivek Shandas studies climate change adaptation and urban heat at Portland State University. Thanks so much for joining us. It's good to speak with you.
Yeah, glad to be here, Peter. Thank you.
And now that you have a second heat wave descending on you, how prepared is the state of Oregon to protect vulnerable people in the next few days of triple-digit temperatures?
Yeah, what we have done is develop a series of kind of short-term emergency responses to the heat waves, and that's just to kind of blunt the acute effects of the heat on really vulnerable populations. And that's things like opening cooling centers, making those messages out early and often about where the cooling centers are, how to access them, and things along those lines. But really, there's a much more fundamental systemic problem at play here that I think is going to take us a lot longer to really dial in and figure out how to prevent some of these deaths that will occur in these heat waves.
So those are the issues that you're studying, but you're also living in it. And I understand that you went out in the last heat wave this summer and you measured temperatures in some neighborhoods in Portland, Oregon, at 121 degrees. Tell me what that felt like.
Yeah, you know, it's like walking into a convection oven. Like, it was just oppressive to the extent to which you could not spend more than half an hour or an hour outside if you're a very healthy, able-bodied person. Thinking about that in relation to people who have to spend outside as day laborers, folks who don't have access to air conditioning, folks whose homes actually end up heating up a lot more than the ambient environment because that air just stays in the house, really kind of gets up to 130 degrees, 135 degrees, and that's what we start seeing. And in fact, the people who died, and the data sets I've been looking at of the people who died, the majority of those are either in very low insulation housing, such as RV trailers or trailer park homes or multifamily residential units or old single-family residential units that don't have great insulation and are very porous to the outside air getting in and heating up those inside spaces.
And so as someone who spends so much of their life invested in this issue, when you see how many people died this summer because of heat, how does that make you feel?
Yeah, you know, I had a recent moment when I looked at the list of all the people who had died. I actually was able to get that from the Oregon Medical Examiner's Office, and I really couldn't even look at it for several days. It really was heart-wrenching to look at these names and these specific addresses and going to ended up going to each one of these addresses and actually not only giving a tribute to the space and the person who lived there, but also really kind of registering that if we don't remember these people, we are going to be seeing a lot more of these names and these addresses showing up on the Oregon Medical Examiner's lists. And what we really need to be doing is checking this as a wake-up call for us to be able to start taking swift action, because this is something that we can prevent, and it's something within our means to be able to do this quickly and effectively.
And speaking of wake-up calls, it happened at a time when the IPCC was preparing a report from scientists around the world explaining how there is no doubt this is human-caused climate change and that it is going to get more and more extreme. What connections do you want to make sure that people understand between what's happening where you are and what's happening across the globe?
You know, I'm in the world of trying to connect this larger phenomenon of climate change, which, you know, some people just say, oh, it's too big, it's too far out for us to even get a handle on, and then to really connect the dots with what's happening locally and how that's playing out in terms of the vulnerability of people, of infrastructure, of ecosystems. And that's where we're really trying to kind of move the needle, is not to say this is something, you know, far out and hard to comprehend. It's something that's taking lives of people today. And we really want to be able to start designing our cities, developing our social infrastructure to be able to get ahead of this as soon as possible.
Vivek Chanda studies climate change adaptation and urban heat at Portland State University, the Pacific Northwest, in the grips of yet another triple-digit heat wave. Thank you so much, and try to stay safe.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be here, and glad you're interested in this topic.
Well, we are. And one big takeaway from that climate report this week from the IPCC is that the planet will just continue to heat up over the next 30 years. People in every part of the world will feel it, and I'm sure a lot of you have been thinking about this. How will climate change affect your life, your kids' lives, the community? We've got a forum at hereandnow.org. Let us know what's on your mind. You can also write us an email at letters@hereandnow.org. Thank you very much.
There are arrowheads in the walls.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei.
I'm Rund Abdelfattah, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
And for our special series this month, The Best of Throughline.
You know, if we carry on as we have been, this is what we might wind up with.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
As the U.S. tries to get more people vaccinated, it finds itself in a supply predicament. In many states, unused vaccines sit on shelves and could soon expire. And as NPR's Will Stone reports, there's pressure not to let those doses go to waste.
While the U.S. is giving out cash and prizes to convince people to get a shot, much of the world is in desperate need of more doses. The situation is dire in Latin America, says Dr. Carissa Etienne with the Pan American Health Organization.
Please don't wait until you have surplus doses. You need to share out of what you have now.
The urgency isn't just because of the alarming global surge of the Delta variant. It's also because many doses sitting in the U.S. could soon be scrapped.
Some countries have reported that millions of undeployed doses might be expiring soon.
Just how many is hard to say. Tens of millions of doses are dispersed across the U.S. Some are reserved for second shots, and it's possible the spike in COVID cases will lead more Americans to get their first shot. Still, given the drop-off in demand, it's likely millions will soon be at risk of expiring.
There should not be one dose wasted right now.
Kate Elder is with the humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders.
It's really a stain on our government if we waste any doses, as it is a stain on other wealthy governments that really took a me-first approach.
The U.S. is expected to have an enormous surplus of doses by the end of the year. Already some states have or are on the verge of destroying tens or even hundreds of thousands. Some states want to send those abroad, but Dr. Marcus Plesha says at the moment they can't.
The guidance has been pretty clear that the federal government just doesn't see that as an option right now.
Plesha is with the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, a group that represents the people who run state health departments.
Most of us have come to realize, you know, once it's out in the states, and particularly if it's been distributed out to local communities, pulling it all back is, you know, it's kind of asking for some kind of error or problem.
The Biden administration tells NPR it's looking into how states could, in theory, return doses already in their control so they can be sent abroad. Prashant Yadav studies medical supply chains at the Center for Global Development. He says this is much harder than shipping out vaccines from stockpiles managed by the federal government.
Bringing back doses that are currently sitting in a very decentralized location is logistically quite complex.
There also appear to be some legal hurdles. Govind Prasad, a law professor at the University of Denver, says states do at least need permission to send doses to countries.
It's not clear what the federal interest is in roadblocking states from doing it as opposed to helping them do it.
Then there are the contracts with vaccine makers. Those are not fully public, but there is some language prohibiting the U.S. from using it abroad. But the administration is already sharing other doses overseas, and Prasad says there are ways to get around the liability concerns. After all, why would drug makers want to sue?
Given that the basic sort of PR of the suit would be, we would rather these vaccines be thrown out in America than used to protect people overseas.
Yes, it may be complex and costly to reclaim these orphan doses, but Prasad says it's still worth trying.
If you get even, 100 vaccines that would help people instead of being wasted, that's something that's actually really important.
And he says we shouldn't lose sight of what those vials sitting on a shelf somewhere represent: human lives that could be saved. Will Stone, NPR News.
Let's get an update now from Iran, which may be the country in the Middle East hardest hit by COVID. There are reports of patients being treated on hospital floors, potentially in mosques, taxis being used as hearses. COVID has taken the lives of more than 96,000 Iranians, according to the health ministry. And NPR's Peter Kenyon is following this from Istanbul. And Peter, what is the latest COVID news from Iran? The Delta variant, the number of cases?
Well, the daily tally of new confirmed COVID-19 cases reported by the Iranian Health Ministry keeps hitting record highs. They're running at about 40,000 new cases every day, with the death toll frequently topping 500 a day. Now, we should point out that from the beginning, some governments have been accused of underreporting both the caseload and the death toll, and that could be the case here. But even these official Iranian figures are quite bad.
Grim. So what is the official line from the government about how it's responding?
Well, Iranian officials and the media, pro-government media, often report on how many people have recovered from COVID-19. That's more than 3.6 million, last I looked. They like to lead with the good news. And then they follow up by saying more than 14 million Iranians have had at least the first dose of a vaccine. Of course, that's in a country of some 85 million people.
Yeah.
Some officials do say American sanctions have been the big problem, hampering the COVID-19 response. The sanctions obviously don't apply to food or medicine. It says so quite clearly. But Iranians say it doesn't matter. Banks simply don't want to deal with Iran for fear of secondary U.S. sanctions.
Now, I want to ask you a little bit more about vaccines. So by my math, that's about one in six Iranians or so having one shot at least. I mean, does the country have enough vaccines?
Well, officials say yes, but frustrated Iranians who've been trying to get vaccinated for months, they say otherwise. I mean, all too often people find supplies have run out at their local clinic. They go and they sign up, and then they find the place is locked when they get there. And critics also point out that Iran hurt itself in January when the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, startled health officials by banning the import of vaccines made in the U.S. or Britain. Now, Khamenei is saying coronavirus is the number one problem, the most important issue facing Iran today. But it seems that his ban on U.S. and British-made vaccines hasn't been lifted yet.
And how about vaccines and citizens in Iran? Are there any vaccine skeptical people there?
No, actually. Iran doesn't have that particular problem. Huh. Iranians are quite serious about getting vaccinated and protecting themselves. They say the problems in Iran are not the result of people being reluctant to get vaccinated. They say it's things like corruption, government mismanagement, also American sanctions. And as far as dealing with the coronavirus, Ibrahim Raisi, the hardline conservative president, has a clear mandate to do it. The supreme leader said, get to it. Whether he can and how quickly he can do that, that's another question, and the answer is far from clear at the moment.
All right, that is NPR's Peter Kenyon in Istanbul. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Scott.
Bought a new bike lately? If so, you would be lucky. Demand for bikes has been booming since the pandemic began. I mean, we all need something to do outside the house, right? Well, the market research firm NPD Group says sales of bikes and bike parts and accessories climbed 57% in April. That's compared to the previous April. And yet, the supply of bikes is crazy tight because of global supply chain snags. We've heard that before, right? With us now is Ira Cargill. She's co-owner of the Gears Bike Shops in the Toronto area in Canada. And Ira, thanks for joining us.
Hi, nice to hear from you, Scott.
Good to talk to you. Let me ask you about the picture at your stores. What does it look like? Do you have customers flooding in, calling, emailing?
So we're actually starting to see a slow in the demand. We are definitely not seeing the same immensity of demand from a year ago. But what we are seeing is demand in certain categories now that can't be filled. So nicer, higher end mountain bikes and road bikes absolutely do not exist in North America. If you have $2,000-$3,000 and you want to buy a road bike or a mountain bike, you can forget about it. We are now finally seeing the entry-level leisure price point. We have stock. So if you were looking for just a step through, I'm going to just start riding around the neighborhood or go with my kids, I could sell you a bike today. But it's pretty sketchy for next year. Supply is actually still tightening up.
Yeah, well, I do want to ask you a bunch about the supply picture. But first, can you perhaps take me back to the start of the lockdown, spring of a year ago? And, you know, at what point did demand just go crazy? And suddenly you had to, I don't know, work all day and all night to try to meet it.
Yeah, we were really uncertain. We've seen a year go by, but there was so much fear on top of just the lockdown. You know, the streets were silent outside of our store. And we were like, how can we sell bikes if no one's outside? It took only 2 weeks to realize that all of a sudden bikes were in demand. Most bike shops repair bikes, so we are considered essential for vehicle service, which was kind of a little loophole for us to be able to stay open somewhat. And then the line started, and then the web store sales literally blew up in a way that no bike shop would have ever experienced. We've never seen anything like it. And then as we got into the winter and the later summer, we realized, hey, wait a minute, the bikes that we normally order that show up at the end of the year, they're not coming. I literally ordered thousands of bikes and we were in the position to competently pre-sell, you know, very organized spreadsheets. We're not going to lose your money. We know what you want. The issue then became when we were told first, hey, bikes are going to come in March, April. Well, now it's April. Okay, yeah, they're going to come in July. And then a couple of weeks ago, those July bikes have now been pushed to late September. So those.
So are you
and then
saying if I purchased, if I ordered a bike last fall, I'm probably going to wait a full year?
Yeah. Yeah. There is a chance that you have emailed me about 17 times and I've gone, hey, Scott, nice to hear from you again. And yeah, I did say April and then we did say July, but sorry. And we know nothing. The biggest A-brand suppliers in North America, they haven't shared anything because they're all still scrambling to try and build and ship out their 2021s.
It sounds crazy. You're in the business and you don't really know what the big bottleneck is. Like you don't know if it's the factories in Asia that aren't keeping up or it's shipping delays or boxes falling off containers on the ocean.
It's funny that you say that because it's all of the above. You know, we're hearing about surges of the Delta variant in Asia and we're hearing about it in factories. A few weeks ago, Shimano, one of the largest parts suppliers globally, closed their biggest Malaysia factory due to COVID.
Oh, wow.
There are shipping container shortages, and that we keep hearing more about. In fact, the largest supplier that did push back the bikes to September used the inability to get their product out of the port because there's no containers. So that was the number one excuse they had. And then the parts, the actual physical parts supply. So we are seeing shortages of specific categories of bikes, and that's because the parts don't exist. I don't think that's because of the containers.
Well, and it sounds like the industry can't just, you know, push the magic emergency PPE button, right? Please, world, just make more. Doesn't sound like that button exists.
No. To give you an example, bicycle tubes, rubber, I don't know what happened in the US, but Canada has seen 5% of the tubes that we ordered and thought we needed. So when we ran out of tubes for the first time ever last summer, spring, we put them on what we call our booking orders for this year. And 5% of those tubes have come to this country. And when they do, if they do by December, there will be more tubes in the bike shops in this country than we will need to reorder for at least 10 years. And now that we're into what we call our booking season for next year, for the first time ever, I have to order product for next year, guessing what people will or won't need. And then I actually have to subtract products that haven't even shown up that I ordered a year ago in maybe an abundance that I will never get through. It's invigorating.
I want to ask you about prices. I mean, right. In other industries, right? If avocados are scarce, the price goes up. It goes sky high. Do you have any ability to raise your prices because there's so many customers chasing not enough bikes?
The prices did go up that we didn't choose to put up, but the suppliers put up to a point where I was actually uncomfortable with some of the prices for the quality of what you were getting. And we, of course, were putting in enormous orders at a regular wholesale, not a discounted clear out price. So every bike in every store today, every bike shop paid top dollar to get it. But if we all of a sudden have a surplus and the consumer starts to ask for the discount and our competitors give in to that, we will now really start to see a problem. Yeah. So you're going to see the loss of a lot of smaller guys.
Ira Cargill is co-owner of the Gears bike shops in the Toronto area. Ira, thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Scott. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
Here is the guest host of Jeopardy, Katie Couric, Ken Jenny, Robin Roberts, LeVar Burton.
After weeks and weeks of celebrity guest host tryouts, it's a double Jeopardy. The game show will have two hosts. Executive producer Mike Richards got the job, and so did actress Mayim Bialik, who will take over primetime specials and spinoffs. News that the job will be shared actually bothered quite a few fans this week, so let's bring in NPR TV critic Eric Deggans to figure out why. Eric, welcome back.
That little bit of audio made it sound like all those guys did one show.
Like it was a busy show.
That would have been an amazing show.
They were clawing
at
each other to see who would win. Look, Eric, I know that 20 million people watch Jeopardy every week, but I still don't understand why so many people care about this search to replace Alex Trebek.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons. Number one, 20 million viewers per show is a lot. I'll remind you that the Olympics in Tokyo averaged 16 million viewers a night in primetime. So Jeopardy did better than that. But part of it is also that the most recent host, Alex Trebek, who passed away of cancer recently, he is a national treasure of sorts. You know, people, I think, are very interested in seeing who will take over as the new steward of the show. And I think that's one reason why this choice was also a little controversial for people.
But, you know, as a casual observer, Eric, it was kind of surprising to me that after this tryout session that was filled with celebrities and big names, that they actually landed on the person that most people had never heard of before, Mike Richards. So why? And what do we need to know about him?
Well, I can't mind meld with the people who, syndicate Jeopardy to find out exactly why they made the choice they did. But Mike is somebody who knows the show. And I'm thinking his pitch to the people who syndicate the show is that he knows how to present the show in a way that's consistent with what Trebek did before, but he's younger. And so it will have a little bit of a younger feel just because he is who he is. But it feels a little bit, you know, people have referenced Dick Cheney, who famously led George W. Bush's search for a vice president and then said, hey, pick me. Yeah. I mean, when you say, how did Mike Richards get this job? I mean, he was in charge of helping them figure out who got the job. So that, I guess maybe that explains it, you know, in a much quicker way.
Well, he won't be alone. The other co-host, Mayim Bialik, people would likely recognize her from her roles in The Big Bang Theory, Blossom. She's also the first woman now to be a permanent host of the game show. Here she is responding to the news recently.
It's been a very exciting and overwhelming day, but in a very good way. Spoke to Mike Richards, who is my fellow host of Jeopardy now. And that was really awesome to get to tell him how I thought all along that he was going to be the host. And it was just really, really nice.
So, Eric, she sounds thrilled, frankly, but I did see you tweeting that adding her feels like an awkward attempt to avoid criticism. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, they had a roster that included a lot of ethnic diversity and women, and then have the main host who gets picked be another white guy. I think people felt that they weren't really genuine in sort of giving people the chance to prove that they could be a worthy successor to Trebek, particularly LeVar Burton, the host of Reading Rainbow, and someone who inspired an online petition that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people signed to try and get him a slot guest hosting. Now, also, Mike Richards, he's executive producer of The Price is Right, and several models have sued that show, saying that they were treated unfairly when they got pregnant, and one of them said that he said some pretty harsh things to her when she let him know that she was pregnant. Those lawsuits have been resolved in different ways. He's either been dropped from them or they settled one of them. So to then have them suddenly, surprisingly announce that there's two hosts and the other host is a woman, it just felt like it was kind of designed to maybe blunt criticism or concern. It's also in the way they announced what Mayim Bialik would be doing.
Right.
It sounds like she's kind of a backup and kind of has an ancillary role. It feels very much like something they kind of hastily put together in order to blunt criticism of the main guy that they picked.
Right. You mentioned LeVar Burton just briefly. This was the fan favorite, right? You mentioned the online petition. He didn't get the job. What have we heard from LeVar Burton?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people could see that the production seemed to have people that it favored. And I don't think LeVar Burton was fooling himself that he had much of a shot. He has said on Twitter that, you know, he was grateful for the opportunity to host it when he did. People have been looking at the ratings of the guest hosts and saying that he had the lowest rating. But the ratings for the show has kind of gone down as there have been more guest hosts. And LeVar Burton was the last guest host. So it seems like maybe the show's core viewers started to tune out a bit. And so now the question is, you know, they hired Mike Richards. Will the ratings rebound when he takes over the show? Or was it more a sense that there's a cadre of viewers who wanted to see Alex Trebek doing it? And it doesn't matter who's going to be the new host. They're not going to watch. And then the ratings for the show is going to go down. That's the question that we have yet to have an answer to.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Scott Tong. It's Here and Now.